From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 50 years ago at Attica. This week marks 50 years since the prison uprising that lasted days and culminated in the state takeover that killed 39 people. 10 guards died, and initially the state claimed that the guards were stabbed to death by the inmates holding them hostage. That was a lie. All of the deaths that came that day came via gunfire. It was the bloodiest prison uprising in U.S. history. Only one guard died at the hands of inmates, and that man was Bill Quinn, a 28-year-old corrections officer who had been trampled and beaten days before when the riot began. Quinn's daughter, Dee, was just 5 years old when she lost her dad. As she writes in a new book, she was at school that day, and school children had become oddly accustomed to sirens and sounds from the Attica prison. It was sort of part of the milieu of life there, but that day was different. Soon she was taken to her grandparents' house. She knew her father had been injured. His death would devastate the Quinn family, and it would change the course of history. The book is called The Prison Guard's Daughter, My Journey Through the Ashes of Attica. Deanne Quinn Miller co-authored the book with longtime Democrat and Chronicle reporter Gary Craig. It is a powerful story, not just of her father and her father's death, but also of bridging racial divides, overcoming prejudice, and finding truth. It is about the narratives and lies told by powerful people and the challenge facing all of us to break through those lies and find truth. The book is available now, and I can tell you, having really spent the last couple of days with it, it's one of the most important books written on local history, but also American history. It is powerful. It reads very quickly and easily, and I encourage everyone to pick it up. The Prison Guard's Daughter, and Deanne Quinn Miller is with us here in studio. Dee, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Gary Craig from the Democrat and Chronicle. Thank you, sir. Nice to have you here as well.
Good. Thank you, Evan.
I know you and Dee have known each other now for a number of years, even before this project became a book. Can I ask you, Gary, I mean, you're a reporter who has reported on Attica for many, many years now. When did you first meet Dee?
2000. And we've communicated throughout the year since, but it was with the inmate settlement in 2000, you know, which was the lawsuit that was finally resolved in 2000. And then the creation of the group that Dee is very central to, the Forgotten Victims of Attica. And I reported on that and got to know Dee then.
Dee, in the book, you start by sort of painting a picture of a town and a group of kids who had grown accustomed to hearing perhaps a siren or something from the prison yard, even sort of remarking that, you know, you figure it might be somebody escaped, maybe a prisoner escaped, they'll probably catch him. It didn't even make you nervous at the idea that somebody escaped. But it became pretty clear that that day was different. Tell listeners a little bit more about what you remember from that day, because as you write, some of your memories are vivid, but some are sort of gone and sort of pockmarked a little bit.
Yeah, many of them are fragmented, but I specifically remember being in school that day. We had just started the school, you know, the year, and the siren at the prison went off, and the school is probably maybe 2 miles from the prison at most. And it just kind of kept going and kept going. And that was something unusual. You know, normally it would blow and then it would just kind of dissipate. And then we would kind of, it would just let the community know that somebody maybe walked off the farm or whatever. But this day it just kept going and going and going. And then sometime after that, our school is probably, I don't know, half of a mile from the fire department. And then that whistle started going off. And I think that's when the teachers also became alarmed. I remember them like turning down the lights in the classroom, and the teachers were kind of out in the hallway talking amongst themselves, because I think that they were very concerned as well. Many of the teachers and subsequently people of the Forgotten Victims of Attica, their husbands were working that day, as my dad was. And I think everybody was, you know, very concerned and knew that something was going on, but they didn't know what.
As a 5-year-old, I mean, it's hard to sort of process all of that, but as far back as you can now remember this 50 years later here, what is the first memory you have of understanding just how serious it was for your dad?
I think the things that started to piece themselves together was when, you know, I was taken from school and I went to my grandmother's house. I was like, why wasn't I going home? Oh, your mom's, you know, going to the hospital to see your dad, okay. And then we stayed at grandma's house, and then we stayed at grandma's house, you know, and I've only spent nights there before, you know, mm-hmm. And here we are kind of over this, we ended up staying there 3 weeks. because it was the time that, of course, my father had died and then the funerals and everything. And I started, you know, I mean, when Dad isn't around for a number of weeks and then you go back to your home, right? So we go back to our little house in Attica on Windsor Street. And Dad's not putting you to bed anymore. My Uncle Bob is, or the neighbors. My mom is crying often, inconsolably. My father's shirt hangs on the back of the desk chair for weeks. And then I think as a kid, that's when you go, he's really not coming back.
He was 28 years old. He was someone who had worked a number of jobs. And what's interesting for me as a reader, there's so much here that Dee and Gary have brought to us in terms of the storytelling of the reality versus the narrative that we had heard. So a narrative, as someone who didn't grow up in Western New York but moved here, I've been here for 20 years, one of the narratives about Attica was, you know, kind of a not very clean, overcrowded prison. That narrative was probably fair, especially in the months leading up to the riot, because the book details some of the efforts that the prisoners, the inmates, had undertaken to try to improve conditions. But Attica was not meant to be that way. In fact, Attica was meant to be sort of a corrective to those conditions in other facilities. Gary, what was it written? I mean, the New York Times back in, was it the 30s?
Yes, I believe the early 30s. It was, you know, written as, you know, it was considered to be the jewel. There had been a string of riots at other prisons, violent, in, I think the late 20s maybe, and conditions were bad. And Attica was, it was built as basically with this belief of this sort of rehabilitative model. And then, you know, just through the years, it became more and more crowded. And I think the rehabilitation in just kind of disappeared the longer we got away from the opening days of it.
And the inmates there, we meet some of the people who throughout the years since have undertaken different efforts that, that Dee introduces us to in this book. They weren't all there for the most violent offenses, but there were plenty of people in the prison who had committed very violent crimes, right, Gary?
Yes, you have to remember at that time there were fewer prisons. So you did have, it was a maximum security. So you obviously had killers, you had people who had done horrific things. But then you would get, you know, some folks who were in, you know, Frank, Big Black Smith, whom we'll probably talk about, you know, robbed a craps game. You had L.D. Barkley from Rochester, who got fatally shot, was in for a parole violation. So you did have this mix. Granted, there was no shortage of people that did some really bad stuff. But then you had this mix there, and I don't know if it was partly because of there's a limited number of prisons at the time, but of people whose offenses were far less significant than those folks.
So in September 9th, 1971, this all bubbles up and spills over. And for the public to see it over the ensuing days, certain narratives emerged. But the reality was leading up to those days, there were efforts by the inmates to try to improve conditions. And in fact, they had worked with the guard, with Michael Smith, among others, to try to say, hey, did these sound reasonable? Here's what we need. We need better conditions, more humane conditions. And taken today, can I ask both of you, I mean, when you read about what the prisoners wanted in the summer of 1971 before the uprising, how does that read 50 years later? It reads as totally reasonable to me what they were asking for, Gary.
Oh, completely. And I think, you know, and you mentioned Mike Smith, you know, the corrections officer who was given sort of the original version of the manifesto, the demands that the inmates made. You know, you're getting, what, a shower a week, a roll of toilet paper a month. You've got more sort of really constitutional type issues, too, with, you know, Muslims being denied the ability to practice their religion. And as you said, they were trying to kind of peacefully address this. And you know, the corrections officers, you know, folks like Dee's father, you know, they recognized what was going on. They wanted, you know, something better, too, because they could feel things sort of simmering and festering because of the way the conditions were and what it was giving rise to.
Dee, I think your book really also, again, we talked narrative versus reality. Mm-hmm. There were multiple narratives depending on what kind of storyline you were believing about Attica. One of the narratives was that the guards, none of the guards cared about the inmates, and they were abusive and they were awful, etc. And that narrative is also unfair in that some of that is true, but then there were people who worked in the prison, like your father, like Michael Smith, who were very different, and the inmates, even during the uprising, sort of recognized that and protected certain people because of how humane they had been. I'm curious to know if that matters, if that has been heartening for you to learn about your dad over the years.
Completely. I mean, it is, you know, for a long time, I didn't know what kind of man my father was, what, you know, what kind of employee my father was. And so putting those pieces together on this journey, which I document in the book, you know, I get to meet these people who tell me the most amazing stories about my dad. And I am forever, you know, grateful for that. And, you know, when Gene Hitchens flies up on his own dime, who is a former inmate, was not in the yard during the retaking, but wants to make sure that people know the story about my dad, that my father protected him because he was a smaller in stature inmate who probably could have been preyed on easily. My father was concerned about that, and that my father would lock him in early before the other inmates would come in and get locked down, just to make sure that he was safe, that my dad would ask him about school, how he was doing, and if he needed anything. I mean, that's, I think my father, you know, putting that piece together and the other pieces that people have, you know, stories that people have told me, I have a picture of my father being, I think, just a great humanitarian who was a correction officer and I think played it fair. And was always watching out for people.
Sure. What was it, almost 30 years after the uprising that Gene Hitchens offered that not only a testimony, but a desire for anyone who knew and cared about your dad to know what he thought of your dad, which is Gene said, you know, he was what, 5'2",
mm-hmm.
you know, and an easy target.
Mm-hmm.
And your dad saw that and took steps to make sure he was checked up on, that he was safe. It wasn't just Gene. He did that for other people.
Correct.
So I'm heartened to know that that matters to you and that that memory of your father is important here. And I don't want to dwell too much on what happened with your dad. I know it's emotional for you, but what matters, I think, about this part of the story that the average listener, like myself, until this book might not know or might not remember, is that your dad was the only prison guard who died not as a hostage and not at the hands of state gunfire.
Correct.
So the riot breaks out, and your father tried to hold back a gate, essentially. I want to be careful and sensitive here, but can you describe a little bit about what happened?
Sure. So my father was working vacation relief that day. So he was in Times Square, which he had worked that job before.
Times Square
is the central hub of the
right.
of the prison. It has many four doors that go out to it, and you lock as they go through, you know, whether they're going to school or inmates are going to chow. And my father worked that before. He was familiar with that area. So he was in that area, and he recognized, I think, well, I think, you know, going back to the conditions, he knew that things were not good. The corrections officers were kind of on high alert for things. And after my father locked the companies and went through into A block, and the door that went into the rec yard was locked, the inmates got really upset because that's typically what ends up happening is they just go through, they go out that unlocked door, that's their rec time is after they have breakfast. And it didn't happen. And that's when the whole thing just erupted. You know, the spontaneous kind of eruption in this tunnel. And at that point, I believe there was 88 individuals in that tunnel with two of the companies that would have been known as trouble companies, right? Men, inmates that were known to be trouble and were locked in these particular areas. They were also in that section. And just all hell broke loose. And my father was watching it. And he went over to the telephone, and he attempted to call somebody in administration, but the phone line was busy, so he couldn't even get through to get help. He realized stuff was going on. He started locking other corrections officers into other gates so that they would be protected. There was a weld in the A gate, and it was the rod that descended into the ceiling or ascended into the ceiling. It had a butt weld. And just was painted, 40 years worth of paint, and as the inmates were rocking it and trying to get through, break down the door, the weld breaks, and the door comes down, leaving my father essentially defenseless. And he has on his belt, of course, the keys to the other corridors. So there's inmates who beat him very severely, took the keys off of his belt, made way to the other parts of the prison, wreaked havoc everywhere. Obviously, at this point is when other hostages are being taken while my father is laying there, egregiously hurt. I mean, he was terribly injured. He sustained two open skull fractures and was bleeding from his eyes and his nose. And he was just a mess. And he was left there as, you know, things were progressing with the inmates taking hostages. And at some point, Richard Clark comes through. And Richard Clark is typically, I think, when people say Richard Clark, people think that he's like one of the head, you know, people of negotiations in D Yard that day of the riot. He came through and he recognized my dad, that was him. And he had gone to A Block and gotten a mattress and then asked three other Muslim inmates if they would help carry my father on a mattress through and into the administration building, where that's exactly what they did. And other correction officers did attempt to help my dad, but they were so terribly injured themselves. Mm-hmm. So they brought him to the administration building, and administration said, you know, fine, that, you know, they're like, he's one of yours and he's terribly injured. They're like, just put him down and go back. So they did. And that's one of the discoveries that I had. I never thought, like, how did my dad get out of Times Square? I just assumed that, of course, corrections of people went in and got my dad, and they got him right out. But that's not what happened at all.
It was the inmate.
It was the inmate.
What did that mean to you when you discovered that?
I was kind of blown away, because in my upbringing, right, inmates bad, corrections officers good. So these bad people did something good. I had to, like, reconcile with that. Also, in my, you know, early familyhood, we had a little bit of racism, right? So, you know, inmates, black, Mexican, Puerto Rican, whatever, bad. White people, good.
All the guards were white.
All the guards were white.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had to wrestle with that. And when Brad Lichtenstein came by and he was doing his Ghosts of Attica, and he said to me, do you want to go to Harlem and meet Richard? He'd love to meet you. And I was like, I mean, I think there came a point in time when I was just like, I'm going to talk to anybody, regardless of race, whatever. Anybody who will talk to me about my dad, I'm going to listen to.
I should be clear to listeners that one of the results of that quest that Dee is talking about is this book, but that is not all. It has been a quest for justice, financial support, state acknowledgement, state apology, which we'll get to coming up here. But even before we get there, I want to do a little contrasting here. As a 5-year-old, you lose your dad. All those narratives are in play. Inmates bad, prison guards good. And it was a pretty simple narrative that your family didn't talk much about it. It was sort of just assumed. Your mother didn't talk much about your dad whenever you brought it up. She usually deflected. It sometimes got emotional. But there was something that happened early in your life that was an indication to readers of your book that you were not going to necessarily sort of fall victim to bigotry. And that was your friendship with a boy named Corey. Can you describe that?
Yeah. So Corey is a boy that I met when I was running track in high school. And, we became very good friends very quickly. But it was a friendship that I didn't share with my family for a very long time. And I didn't share it because he was black. It's kind of a difficult thing to talk about. So Corey and I have stayed friends and have been the best of friends for years and years and years, even making sure at one point that we both ended up going to the same college. And it was, you know, such a good thing. We have known each other since we were 14 years old. And he's just been, he had his own tragedy in his life. He's always just been a wonderful listener, gives great advice. You know, I love him dearly. I just knew that a romantic relationship with Corey would be something that would be out of the question, because I would eventually have to choose back then whether it would be my family or Corey. And that was a discussion that we had.
Most acutely, it was your stepfather, you're right. Your mother had remarried,
mm-hmm.
And you write that your stepfather, unfortunately, was quite racist. And even to the point where if Corey would call and he would answer, if your stepfather answered, he would lie and say you weren't available. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. My stepfather was working for a sheriff's department. And I think that just solidified that kind of racism thing. I think he's much better now, but back then, that's kind of what he was like and a lot of people were like in the 70s.
Did you ever confront him directly and say, you know, Corey is someone who's close to me and I need you to accept that?
Yeah. Well, we've had conversations about Corey. Mm-hmm. Usually the end ended up with, you know, you're just not allowed to see him.
Forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That part of the book, Gary Craig, to me was really powerful and telling. As short as a section on Corey as it was, it just says so much about Dee. What did you make of that?
Oh, no, very much. And just sort of testament after the writing, you know, just again to the sort of person she is, you know, hope you don't mind me saying this, but I'll tell the story. she didn't blindside anybody with this. She called her stepfather and read those sections to him. And which I thought was such a decent and honorable thing to do.
Oh.
And as Dee said, you know, that I think we tried to make clear that, you know, sadly there was a strain of that racism that was, we'd like to think it's not as rampant now, I'm not sure, but at least sort of maybe in certain communities it was there. So yeah, he wasn't an outlier at that time. His views weren't outliers.
I actually think the book does a very fair job of pointing out, I think you used the phrase that he was a product of the time, but that still doesn't make that okay to you. And what was it like reading that section to him?
He was very quiet when I finished. And he said, you know, Dee Dee, I know that I was bad back then. And he said, you know, working at the sheriff's department, I think, made it worse. He said, I'd like to think that I'm much better now. And I said, Dad, I think you are.
I find that deeply moving. Deeply moving. Sometimes as a society these days, understandably so, bigotry and hurt and wounding is viewed with a permanence. And your stepfather is someone who clearly needed some time and space, but that's a powerful thing.
It is.
It's very powerful. Why did he think working for the sheriff's department exacerbated that in him? Did you ever say? Do you have a thought about that?
Well, I mean, certainly. I think that there's racism in all aspects of law enforcement. You know, we saw it with corrections officers. We've seen it with state troopers. We've seen it with, you know, sheriffs. I think it was, again, like Gary was saying, it was a sign of the times. I mean, it wasn't at all, I don't think, unnatural or unusual for that kind of talk and language to be an acceptable thing back then, you know, sadly.
Talking to Deanne Quinn Miller, who co-authored this book with longtime Democrat and Chronicle reporter Gary Craig. It's called The Prison Guard's Daughter, My Journey Through the Ashes of Attica. Dee was 5 years old when her father, Bill Quinn, died at Attica. He was a prison guard who was trampled and beaten. And his death even changed some of the course of the negotiations and what happened in the days that followed. And after we take this only break of the hour, let's talk about what came next here and how important it has been in the 50 years now since Attica that the full story of what happened is acknowledged, that all of the people who were victimized in various ways are made whole, and what it means to be in a state that has seen governor after governor, administration after administration deflect on any accountability for this. That's all part of this story, and that's next. Coming up in our second hour, we welcome Dr. Bradford Burke with us. He's the former CEO of the University of Rochester Medical Center who was permanently paralyzed after a bike accident in 2009. He went back to work as CEO about a year later, and he has learned so much in the last decade about trauma, brain injury, permanent injury, spinal cord injury, and more. And we'll talk about it coming up.
This is Veronica Volk from WXXI News, and we've got a new weekly podcast for you. It's called Earshot, and it's got all the most important, best told, sometimes off the beaten path news stories from your favorite WXXI and city reporters. Earshot comes out every Friday. Don't miss it. Subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and it is 50 years since Attica, the deadliest prison riot in U.S. history, that was a story of, frankly, state lies and a misunderstood set of facts here. Now, there is a book by Heather Ann Thompson that we have talked about on this program that is sort of the definitive and holistic view of what happened. But this book, I think, is a companion to that because it talks about all of the impacts on families, but it also is a journey of discovery and, frankly, healing. We're going to talk about Frank Smith coming up, but before we do that here, let's just make sure we understand just how important Dee's father's death was that week. When Bill Quinn died, he died, what, official death was 2 days later?
Two days later on the 11th.
September 11th. So it comes at a time when there's talk of negotiations, some sort of a settlement, but there was some talk of amnesty for his death, and the state didn't want that. And that made, at least from everything that I've read and seen, that made negotiations more difficult. It all builds up to a state takeover that started with tear gassing, helicopters overhead, and then about 6 minutes of gunfire. The inmates had taken hostages, and there are famous images of them holding hostages at knife point. And initially, the state wanted to everyone to believe that that the hostages, the guards who died, were stabbed to death by the inmates. It was a very brave coroner who was willing to, and who was that, Gary Craig?
Dr. John Edlund.
That had to have been a very brave and difficult thing to stand up and contradict the state and say, no, there are no stab wounds to discuss. These are all gunshot wounds, and the only one with the guns were the state. I found that to be tremendously admirable.
Yes, and you know, sadly, Dr. Edlund became his own casualty. He was harassed. He was, you know, by everybody from communities, at some state police. You know, he sort of slipped into severe depression and actually ended up being institutionalized for a while before sort of coming out of it and going into teaching. His family actually is going to be coming for the 50th. His daughter and her husband, I think their child, I believe, is going to be coming for the 50th anniversary on Monday.
One of the heroes of the story.
Very much.
One of the real truth tellers here. And yet there still was this persistent sort of not only public narrative, but the state denial of responsibility. And D, it was a radio host, a talk radio show. We all know talk radio is very powerful. I say that with a tremendous amount of bias here. But it was a radio host who went to Attica, after getting a phone call to the show, not knowing if, hey, if I do 90 minutes in Attica and I open it up and we want to try to get the story here, will anybody listen? Tell us when this happened and a little bit of the story that was, I think, a big turning point sort of moment here.
Yeah, so this is kind of crazy because I wasn't even listening at all to the radio station. I had heard it through somebody else, but Debbie Horton and John Carberry.
We only wrote the book. Thanks for remembering it.
That's okay.
Sorry about that. So they did a radio show on Attica, and somebody called, you know, and said, if you really care about Attica and you care about the truth and what happened here, why don't you come to Attica? So they did. They found a way to pick up, and they went, and they had it at the Signature Cafe in G.B. Smith.
And when was this, by the way?
This was in 1999, I think it was. Because it was well before we formed.
Yeah.
But, you know, so G.B. Smith called me, and he was a retired hostage who had survived. And he calls and he says, hey, you know, a bunch of us are going to get together at the Signature Cafe, you know, if you want to come down. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I want to do this.
By now you're in your 30s.
Yes.
You had gone through a lot. You'd gone through health issues, stomach issues. It was difficult for you to even talk about your father's death. It was hard for you to be in classes growing up where the lessons were taught. You had to excuse yourself a lot. So you'd been through a lot, even though I know you wanted to pursue the truth. I mean, you were the kind of kid who, when your parents were out, you'd flip through the official report on this, trying to learn what was really going on. So you have this push-pull between you, and you decide you're going to go.
I decide I'm going to go.
You're going to go.
I'm going to go. I'm going to take my sister and my mom. And we get there, and we just kind of stand back, you know, stand back against the wall, because we just kind of want to blend in. And there is all these people there. And like somebody, I could hear people saying like Cunningham, you know, Montleone, and they were, I could hear people like saying people's names, and I knew them from the book, right? From the McKay Commission that I wasn't supposed to read because it had naked men on the front. you know, and I it's like all these, and I remember like thinking to myself, all these people like lost somebody in the riot. These must be these families that I read about. And then, you know, the show goes on and people get up there to talk. And one of the people that I speak about that comes to talk is Mike Smith, you know, who was shot five times. And I had no idea who this individual was. And he gets up there and he tells his story. And I don't know. I have this thing like where I feel like when someone's telling the truth, like it resonates kind of within you. And people were telling stories and I was like, you know, listening, whatever it is. But when Michael spoke, I felt as if that was the truth, like that that was a truth that I was looking for, that somebody was finally telling me the truth about Attica. All the books that I read, all everything, people I've spoken to. And I was like, while he was speaking, I was like mesmerized. I was hanging on every word.
Who was Mike Smith, by the way?
Mike Smith is a correction officer who was 22 years of age at the time of the Attica riot. He was shot five times, four times in the stomach by an AR-15 and a 270 in the elbow. And he was just this young guard. Most people would recognize him because he's on TV, you know, when they run the old clips. He's got the black shirt on, they're retying his thing. And by the way, he was one of the first people to see the manifesto in early July. So Mike is at this radio station and he's...
Could I just... when she says manifesto, that's the set of inmate demands or desire for change. They shared it with Mike because they trusted him, and they were kind of bouncing off him. What do you think of this? And they wanted more humane conditions. So Mike was respected as a prison guard, and he survived those gunshots. So here you are in 1999. And when he is speaking and you're saying it feels like truth, it is not necessarily the story that has been shared. And it wasn't all that popular either. What was the story he was telling?
It was not popular at all. And you could hear people kind of in the room talking underneath their breaths. But he talks about, you know, how, you know, the state police had no plan to save the hostages. This was a plan to retake a building. You know, he talks about, you know, obviously about my father's death as well, you know, being the turning point and what it felt like that day being in the yard when they had found out that my dad, you know, had passed. And Michael's story, you know, about his beliefs, I finally have met somebody who's kind of, you know, I had all these pieces, but I didn't really have them all together. Michael had them all together. And then as soon as he got done talking, I couldn't wait to like be able to walk over to him and say thank you for telling your story, because I think I just heard the truth.
Not everyone was thanking him, though.
Oh, no.
I mean, because when Michael is saying, there's two big sort of points that Michael is making that's hard for people to hear, which is that the conditions in the prison really were bad. It was an inhumane. And this state takeover, which the state wanted people to believe was an attempted rescue, was just about taking it back by force, and if people died, they were going to die. When you shoot indiscriminately and you end up with 39 people dead, including 10 hostages, and you can say, well, we tried to save everybody. Michael's saying, they didn't. That's not what this was about. They didn't care if people died. And then when the takeover happens, the torture of some of the inmates that happens at the hands of the state. So all of this, this, which is, by the way, the truth, what he's describing there is true. It still was difficult for some people to hear it. For some reason with D, it hits you and you realize, no, this is much more, for some reason it hits you and you didn't find yourself shouting back at it.
No.
And you wanted to pursue more at that point.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you did. You decided you were going to meet and talk to anybody who would talk to you. And I want to ask you about a man by the name of Frank Smith, whose nickname was Big Black. And Gary Craig has written, because you knew Frank Smith, who died, I think, in 2004 of cancer.
Yes.
Frank had been an inmate at Attica, and as Gary mentioned, he was in there because he robbed a craps game. He was a big guy. He was a big black guy. And it was difficult for you, Gary Craig, to honor his wish to go by his nickname of just Black or Big Black.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, Frank and I'm from North Carolina, and Frank, after the inmate settlement, he and his wife moved to North Carolina, and we would talk occasionally, talk as much about North Carolina as we would about, you know, Attica or anything. And I just, I don't know, it just felt wrong for me to call him by his race. I couldn't quite get my head around that. But every
time, Gary, call me Big Black or call me Black. People call him Black.
Exactly. And every time, you know, he would call me occasionally in that voice, you know, that baritone voice, would go, Gary, it's Black. And finally, just, you know.
You would say, okay, hi, Frank.
Yes. but finally, I said, okay, you know, that's who he was. That's who he was. That's who he wanted to be. And I said, you know, who am I to?
And clearly, he was intensely comfortable with who he was.
Oh, very much. Yes.
And, you know, Frank was not a guy who would ever tell you, I don't see race. He would say, I see race and I'm comfortable with it. We're going to talk about it. Fascinating guy to read about. I've watched interviews with him. He does have this real, I think it was called as a James Earl Jones baritone. He really does. He's got a great radio voice. I wish he were here today for that purpose. But Frank was a guy who throughout this, the days during the uprising, there was stories about him. That he was this dangerous big black man who had castrated a guard and stuffed the guard's testicles in his mouth.
Mm-hmm. And Mike Smith was
Mike Smith was that guard. Mm-hmm. And Mike Smith had to tell people, didn't happen. And yet what happened to Frank when the state finally gets in there? They tortured him, right?
They absolutely did. Yeah. And Frank, you know, was, I don't know if he made himself or if somebody said to him, you know, we need to have a security circle around these hostages. But it was Frank who made that security, you know, the circle around our hostages. And he told those individuals that he chose, you protect these employees with your life. That's your job. If you can't do it, walk away. And that's what he told me on the evenings that we would talk.
Yeah. But the state gets in there. They lay him down at a table naked. He's got to hold a football under his chin, and they are burning him with cigarettes. But they tell him, if you let the football drop, we're going to kill you.
Yeah, and then they're beating him as well. And, you know, as you said, the football's there under his chin and telling him if it rolls off.
If you
know, meanwhile,
off.
They're, you know, some of them from the catwalk dropping lit cigarettes upon him. And then even after that, when he finally is able to leave that, he gets beaten again.
Just horrible. Yeah. And the question for the reader that becomes clear throughout this book is, who were the victims of Attica? Who deserves some sort of justice? And for someone like Dee, that's a hard question for a 5-year-old, a 10-year-old, a 15-year-old. And as you get older, there was a part of you that kind of thought, I mean, and certainly for many people in town, the inmates are not the victims here. You can't give them money. The state doesn't owe them anything. And that was a very powerful idea. When did you really feel that start to shift in you?
I would say the shift probably, you know, as I was, you know, continuing to investigate and, you know, the Forgotten Victims of Attica was making progress. I think probably for me, it started really shifting before the settlement for us in 2004. You know, I just started looking at, you know, what had the state done and who did they do it to? And how do I feel about that particular group? And so things that used to be kind of black and white to me ended up turning a little bit gray, you know, and that's kind of where I sit now. I sit very comfortably with the way that I feel about, you know, the responsibility of everyone who is a victim of Attica. And in my mind, that is our 50 families. It is the inmates. It is some state troopers. It is some National Guardsmen, and it is the townspeople of Attica. All these people have trauma related to Attica in their own way. And the fault, as far as I'm concerned, lays squarely at the feet of New York State government and at the time our governor.
You, in your conversations with Frank, got some answers. He was willing to answer anything. Mm-hmm. The one thing you didn't ask him about was his own torture. You felt like you had heard enough of that. And you didn't want to put him through that. But you asked him a lot of questions otherwise. And it's interesting, you say you never met him in person, but you had many phone calls with him. Gary had struggled to call him Black or Big Black. Did you get around that? How did you end up squaring that up?
I just said to him, I said, Black, I don't feel, I mean, Frank, I don't feel comfortable calling you Black. He's like, D, everybody calls me Black. He's like, well, let's do this. You call me Big Black and I'll call you Little White. And I was like, I'm good with that.
That's wonderful.
So, little, okay. Little White. Did he call you Little White?
Yeah, he used to call me, how you doing, White? I said, I'm good, Black.
and you got comfortable calling him Black. And I know that relationship was really important to you. As much as it was hard to ask him questions about what he saw or what he knew, what do you feel like you learned from him that made a big difference to you?
I learned a lot from Frank. I think I learned, you know, yeah, I mean, he's just, Frank was, I mean, he went through, I mean, you guys just described, you know, in this terrible detail, which is just so cringeworthy, you know, what happened to him. Yet he was not necessarily bitter still, you know? He was so good at just kind of putting it behind him and, you know, and at the same time rooting for us, right? Because while he settles in 2000, we're still in the process. So, you know, Frank writes a letter to Governor Pataki and says, listen, you need to finish this up. You know, Frank writes a letter and says, you need to give these people compensation. You need to give them an apology. All these, you know, our 5-point plan for justice that we had. Frank writes the letter. But in the calls at night that we had, I just learned about his tolerance, I think, and his just absolute love of people and life. And what happened to him was not going to define him. And I don't know if I can say this, but I think I'm just going to say it. At his funeral in North Carolina, nobody knew. He had gone down there to start a new life, him and his wife, Pearl. And he's in North Carolina, and he passes away, and there's a funeral. And people go down. It's probably my one regret. Brad goes down there, Brad Lichtenstein, and he quickly realizes that nobody knows that Black was an inmate during Attica and that he had done all the stuff. So people wanted to know. He said, I stood at the side of the casket, leaning on the side of Frank's casket, telling everybody who Frank really was. He didn't want to be known. He worked in a center for youth that were at risk, and he volunteered his time, and nobody knew who he was. He literally just kind of didn't. He wanted to live the last part of his life, I think, just in anonymity, just out there helping young men and women, you know. And that's what he did, and nobody knew his past.
What did you think New York State owed someone like him and other inmates?
Probably the same thing that they owe us, an apology.
Can I read what you wrote about that?
Sure.
Because Dee notes that when she started this quest for justice, justice means different things. What you figured from the outset was, well, the easy thing will be, we'll get an apology. We will get acknowledgement and accountability, because that's easy. What we now know is the state lied. I mean, we know that the narrative they tried to sell is not true. And time has passed here. Here's what you write about that. Apology would be a demand most likely agreed to. I did not imagine a world in which government leaders could not recognize the calamitous and deadly errors of Attica, or could recognize them, yet decide the state had no reason to apologize. As we approach the 50th anniversary of the uprising, with this writing, we have worked with 4 gubernatorial administrations, Pataki, Elliot Spitzer, David Patterson, and now Andrew Cuomo. We have met with high-ranking officials in all of the administrations, and still do, yet constantly confront this unbudging attitude that one administration cannot apologize for the mistakes of another. End quote. Well, now there's a Hochul administration.
Right.
Do you have any hope that will change?
I'd like to have hope.
I mean, she's from Buffalo. She's not, I mean, she's certainly aware of Attica. Not
well,
that far.
Well, I think so. Yeah. I mean, she's a Western New York girl.
Yeah.
Right? And Hamburg isn't that far from Attica.
Yeah.
And I suspect she was probably a teenager at the time. So I'm very hopeful that the new governor will come and offer an apology.
Now, on top of the apology, there is a long, and the book details this, Gary Craig, the work to at least try to get some sort of financial compensation, and the sort of the starts and stops, et cetera, here. How did you, having co-authored this book, come to view the question of justice when there are questions for years about financial compensation, mm-hmm. who gets what, how to divide the money? But what does justice mean to you?
You know, I think getting to the ultimate truth by getting as many facts out there as you can. And that's one component of it, obviously. That's a big component of it. And it's amazing when we deal with something that's now 50 years old and it's been analyzed. I mean, there's multiple books, there's studies, you know, there's investigations. And it seems like yet there's still things we don't know and we continue to discover, which speaks to the unwillingness of some to allow the full story to get out. So I think that's the big part of it. And to me, the apology, you know, there's just, I'm like Dee, I don't really understand. We addressed it in the book. There was a task force that worked with Dee's group, the Forgotten Victims, and put out this litany of errors that the state had made, deadly errors, you know, whether it was the conditions, whether it was the retaking. And yet after admitting, you know, all these lapses, then basically says, oh, but we can't say we're sorry. And it just, that part, I guess, just still flabbergasts me that how hard is that to say? And there's historical precedents for that. It's not like it's new.
The book, we haven't even gotten to some of the other people who are probably, frankly, in that heroes category, the Tom Wickers, the Malcolm Bells, mm-hmm. Judge Telesca. I mean, there's a number of people who have, I would hope, offered a reason to have some confidence in humanity. But Tom Wicker himself said to you that this episode has made him lose faith in government generally, that he always thought that government is there to protect the people. And Attica and the subsequent years since Attica has shook that faith from Tom Wicker. Mm-hmm. By the way, tell listeners who Tom Wicker was.
So Tom Wicker was a, I think, very well-known New York Times writer. And he wrote about all sorts of things. And I think prison and prison reform was some of the things, you know, that he used to write about. Wonderfully intelligent man, I think. Willing to listen to any story. It was probably one of the highlights of my discovery when I was working on Attica was to go and meet Tom Wicker in person just before he passed.
And so he did write about prison reform. This book gives us a lot to think about. Here, 50 mm-hmm. years after Attica, what reforms do you still want to see in American prison systems?
That's difficult because I'm aware of some of the reforms that have been made, though I don't, you know, this is really not necessarily my, you know, bailiwick, if you will. I mean, obviously, I would like for corrections officers to have a safer environment to work in, but I would also like inmates to be safe and well and busy in there. I mean, obviously, having programs and so on. It doesn't seem to be that that's where we are right now, because you can read in the news any day of the week that we are having issues within our prisons. Auburn just recently had a terrible incident and was locked down for a number of days. You know, I think we have a different type of criminal now than what we did then. And I'm not sure that our prisons are not as maxed out, because we've had several close mm-hmm. with three more potentially on the horizon. So it's potentially just going to get worse.
The book is called The Prison Guard's Daughter, My Journey Through the Ashes of Attica. Gary Craig is the co-author of the book. Events coming up? What's coming up for you guys? I should say the book is out now.
Yes.
And it's available.
Yep.
And listeners, you should buy a copy and support the effort, because this one is important.
Thanks so much, Evan. September 18th is Saturday. We're at Pittsford Barnes & Noble from 2 to 4. The following Saturday, we're at Webster Barnes & Noble from 2 to 4. We're doing the Ewing Forum in Canandaigua, October 3rd with you. And there's a website, theprisonguardsdaughter.com, which has those events and others that we'll be doing.
And as we get ready to wrap here, Deanne Quinn Miller, if the governor of New York State, if Kathy Hochul, calls you tomorrow and says, listen, this state should never have taken this long to make this effort, but we're going to issue a formal apology and an acknowledgement of accountability for Attica. Your eyes went wide a little bit there. Is that enough, or is there more that you need from the state?
I would take that. I would take that. Yeah. At this point, you know, I'm tired. I've been doing this for a long time, but I can't stop with the apology. But if Kathy Hochul said something like that, I think that would be acceptable.
Have you lost faith in the same way that Tom Wicker did?
Oftentimes I do. But like I said before, I really like to have hope. I want to be optimistic. I want to believe that people can see the wrong and right it. And I'm so hopeful that that is something that our new governor can do.
This book has given us just enough of a life raft of hope, I think, from people like yourself, Frank, the judge, Tom Wicker. There's a lot of names here. Michael Smith. I mean, there's a lot of people who were willing to do the coroner that we talked about. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who are willing to do what was right and damn the consequences. To do what's right and let the consequences follow, even when you know those consequences will be tough. But there are people who have been willing to do that. Thank you for bringing them to the page with this. And thank you for the work that you're doing on this. Thank you for being here. Gary Craig, thank you.
Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
Deanne Quinn Miller and Gary Craig, co-authors of The Prison Guard's Daughter, My Journey Through the Ashes of Attica. This week marks 50 years since the uprising. More Connections coming up.